Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Pony Sync call for the 30th of November. Let's dive right in. Let's start with RFCs. And the one that's ready for vote is number 69, Behaviors Should Return None. Looks good to me. With the chaining, this is a really nice change. It especially improves the subtyping relationship. Anyone else have any thoughts? Is that tacit acceptance?
My thought is yes.
That's a good thought. All right, excellent. Then we will merge it. All right, cool. What do we mark it with? Request?
As far as I know, we don't mark it with anything.
Right, cool.
Just remove the old label, and what it needs is the workflow of getting an issue ticket opened in the main repository.
Okay. Sounds good. The other one that I thought we might talk about a little bit is Nuke Return This, number 68.
Yeah, and I think it's been in final comment period, it looks like, for 12 days, so it might actually be ready for vote, but not sure I'd actually go ahead and do it without Benoit here.
Okay, yeah, we'll aim to do it next week and hopefully catch both Benoit and Sean. I really, really liked your point about separating the interfaces between mutable interfaces and immutable interfaces. That's really, really good. Just saying that. and trying to be consistent about how update and remove would be mutable, but add and sub would be immutable across the types.
Yeah, even for a mutable type, we can, as you said, we can emulate the persistent style operation.
Yeah, exactly. And it sort of makes me wonder. So far, for example, on set, the operator overloads behave in an immutable way, and I sort of wonder if with method specialization, if and when we do receiver specialization, we might want to have a situation where they would mutate if you were doing it on something mutable and would not if you weren't. But maybe that's too confusing for the end user.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, for me, I look at arithmetic as being sort of, you know, like the operator overloads, they're sort of modeling arithmetic, and I look at that as being immutable operations because
right.
The things you're adding in arithmetic are typically immutable or always.
Yeah.
So it would seem weird to me if I guess this is how I would sum it up, is it would seem weird to me if one of those mathematical looking operations had a side effect on one of its two operands.
Yeah.
I mean, the case where I think this is different is, like, for example, in the options package, that point that I discussed with Benoit on the ticket,
in the
options package, using the plus sign as a little cutesy factory, I don't know a better word for it, but just like sugar for a factory style operation. I think that's a little bit different, and I think that's okay. And
right.
I personally like the sort of cutesy operator overloading for factories.
I hate to admit it, but I totally do too. Like, as long as it isn't really unpleasant to decipher, it can provide a really nice looking result. So,
yeah, especially when they eventually get back around to more of the implementing more compiler stuff in Pony, doing grammar specifications in language using the QC operator overloading, as if it's sort of the grammar notation is kind of and concise.
In that vein, I was giving a Pony lecture at Imperial College yesterday, and someone was pointing out that Pony could have arbitrary operator overloading, and in fact could allow any symbol to be used as a function name if we required spaces around operators. And that's an interesting thing to think about. I'm not saying we should do it, because it would be a big change, right? To be able to have to say one space plus space one. It's sort of very lispy in a funny way.
What I would say is we could do it so first of all, I mean, that doesn't seem necessarily like it's right to me. For example, what if I have A on one line, so A, new line, plus B on the next line. Am I calling, or sorry, I should say plus parentheses, B and parentheses. Am I just saying A is an expression on the first line completely separate, and the next line calls the plus method with B as this is the only argument, or am I doing plus? Am I calling the plus method of A with B? So what I would say would be a requirement is instead of dealing with white space, I think we could make it so that basically, if you were using a an identifier that is not legal now for a method name, then you had to do this dot, whatever your method is. Or obviously for any other receiver, you do whatever that is, dot the method name. But there would be no implicit this dot for those methods. And I think that was one of all the cases.
That's very interesting. Yeah. And that, okay. That's the thing to think about, because we would want to be able to keep, of course, the operator sugar of not needing the dot, right?
Right.
So yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, it would be operator sugar if there was no dot, but if you were trying to just invoke it as a method without sugar,
yeah,
it would always be receiver dot method name. There would be no this dot sugar for method names that were not following whatever our required identifier path would be.
Right.
Something in a similar vein to this, somebody brought up in IRC at one point Unicode function names. So,
yeah.
Yeah, like allowing for, you know, an umlaut over whatever letter, or I guess an emoji as a method name.
Somebody really wants to call the poop method, and that's how that goes. People have certainly introduced that. Like, I think JavaScript allows that now, and probably some other things as well. Part of me says I would really like to support that, because the idea of being able to write code in your native language, modulo keywords, it seems very reasonable to me. But it definitely would require a really wide sweeping thinking about what constitutes an identifier and how we know we're on another identifier. That's
interesting too. It also probably, would go along with sort of a more general, like, Unicode compatible overload, overhaul for the compiler already, as it is. But I think, as far as I know, they're compatible with LLVM. LLVM can have whatever.
Arbitrary byte strings, yeah. We already allow Unicode in strings, of course, right now, UTF-8 in strings. It's purely a question, well, I say purely, it is a question of identifiers, and it is a darn tricky question, right? But it's a really interesting one, because the other side is to say, hey, ASCII is incredibly portable, and there's a reason we've been limiting certain kinds of character sets to ASCII for a very long time, and it mostly has to do with portability. So yeah, I don't know.
I mean, definitely, I think it would.
If we did do something like this, this is the part of the call where I just troll Sean, even though he's not here. If we did do something like this, it would allow hyphens in identifiers, which would make Sean incredibly happy.
Yeah. Although, would it be a different? Would it be a different character than we use for minus? Like, are you talking about like using M dash versus N dash or something?
No, you could actually just put minus in, because if this kind of change would necessitate stronger delineation between identifiers, and you could start doing things like having complex identifiers that contained operator-like symbols, because you would be separating all symbols, all tokens with white space, which of course has its problems.
Yeah, the white space trick would do it. I was still thinking about the other alternative, of the just requiring this dot for methods, which.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it will take spelunking on the grammar and the lexer to make sure that it works right. Right, it will take careful consideration, because how you bind the lexer is tricky. Like, can you have something that starts with plus? Can you have an operator that's, you know, plus slash, or are we going to parse that as plus and then slash? Like, it's problematic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can't refer to a method name without calling it. And so, I think my trick would only apply to methods. I don't think you could make it work for, at least without tweaking, I don't think you can make it work for fields.
Right.
Because it would be requiring that basically, like, when you see this dot, you are going to read until you see basically like a space or an opening parentheses, I think.
Right.
Like white space or opening parentheses would be your call to say, okay, my identifier is done for the method name.
Right.
And you have to do the same thing following the fun RCAP construction, you know, fun tag. Right. And now read until you get a white space or parentheses.
Yeah, that makes sense. Interesting.
But at that point, it might be weird that it's different for methods versus fields. But I mean,
it would introduce a dependency between the lexer and the parser in a kind of unfortunate way, because your parsing state would influence the kind of lexing you did next.
Right.
Which is certainly possible, but might be unpleasant.
Well, I mean, we talk about the parsing grammar being LL1, but if you think about the lexing as part of the parsing, it's not LL1 at all. You know, there's a
lexing is its own crazy thing, right? Like, lexing has to be deterministic, without context, but not deterministic on the input stream, right? Because you're never backtracking. You're only going, "Oops, I'm switching my categorization because of the next thing," but you don't backtrack. So yeah, you're right. It's technically LL1, but it is useful to think about the fact that you are reading ahead and changing what you're interpreting. So you're right.
Yeah, but you're also right that obviously if you're the lexer isn't supposed to have this kind of knowledge of the context.
Right.
That is dependent on parsing.
Right.
But I don't know. Having done a lot of peg grammars, I'm always thinking in terms of pegs where there is no.
And I'm actually totally open to changing our approach and saying that we're peg without backtracking as opposed to LL1, right? Like if we say we're peg without backtracking, I think that is still a reasonable standard for tool writers because it means you can do accurate recursive descent without backtracking. And that's really what people want out of life, right? Like, it's not so much. Yeah, you know, kids and recursive descent parsers. So I would be open to that. And peg, you know, as you well know, peg grammars have a hell of a lot of stuff going for them, like not drawing a distinction between a parser and a lexer. So. Yeah. All right. That was useful to me because it clarifies some of my thinking. I'm also thinking about this in terms of Sean trolls me on a regular basis that he wants macros. And one of the things I've been thinking about is could we have some useful concept of F expressions instead of macros. Do you know about F expressions from the very, very old days of Lisp?
I mainly know about them from our previous discussions. Last time, last time we were talking about macros, we talked a little bit about F expressions.
Cool. Okay, so I've already bored everybody with that.
right. Yeah, but go ahead.
Yeah, and then that got me thinking that the new lambda syntax is a thing of beauty. And if we had a useful way, and we don't right now, but if we had a useful way of being able to write a lambda that takes no arguments as simply braces around an expression, and everything, and we would figure out that it took no arguments, and we would use type inference to determine its return type, etc., all that kind of stuff. Then that would be a really clean way to write the equivalent of an F expression, right? It's a func. You've written a func just by putting braces around it. And that kind of ties into this idea of peg grammars and stuff. So I don't know. That's just a thing I was thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of... maybe we should recap a bit about F expressions then, because basically... The idea is that, you can tell me if this is right, the idea is that the expression is parsable and resolvable without knowing any of the details of the macro, or that, you know, that is, it's already parsed and resolved. The expression itself is already parsed and resolved before it ever gets to the macro, and the macro sees the already resolved version of that. Is that right?
So, right. So, the difference between an F expression and expression in Lisp in the bad old days was that an F expression's arguments weren't evaluated before they were passed to the F expression. So, instead, the F expression would be passed the AST for those arguments.
Right.
Which is... So what I'm talking about isn't going that all the way to F expression, which is also interesting, right? And that gets into AST manipulation, which is maybe more what Sean really wants. I'm not sure. But part of it is delayed evaluation of saying, if I'm not going to use this thing, don't do any work.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Probably we shouldn't spend too long on that because that's like easily the next month of conversation. I don't know if really just having a really clean lambda syntax for delayed
I think I lost you there. Sylvan, I think I lost you in mid-sentence. Are you still there?
There we go. Am I back?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think you were saying you were saying something like, I don't know if just having the better syntax for lambda expressions, or sorry, for delayed evaluation is enough.
Right. Exactly, because I don't know if really what we want is more of the true macro ability to rewrite the AST.
Yeah, so, I mean, rewriting the AST is something that I sort of like from a sort of coolness, like flexibility perspective. But I think from a more practical perspective, like sort of a lower hanging fruit that is still sort of beyond what we can already do is, and this may not be what Sean wants. I mean, I know Sean's emphasis on macros seems to be around trying to find ways to use them to speed up performance, which is an important goal. But it's for me, it's more of a thing, you know, so we have these, in a source file, we have these sort of two contexts. You have the declarative context where you're declaring types and their methods and their fields. And you have the imperative context within a method where you're just executing expressions one after the other.
Okay.
What I'm looking for a lot of times when I wish I had a macro was basically a way to bundle up some reusable logic at the declaration level.
Okay.
To do something like, I want to declare these 20 types, and they have these 20 names, and they're all declared using this strategy. You know, they have these fields, and you know, to condense a lot of the repetition in a concise way, especially when there is some sort of hairy things going on with like the fields being different. I mean, a common use case for this would be if you had like a finite state machine system with a lot of states.
Yep.
And what I end up spending a lot of time doing with this is basically trying to massage things together with various type parameters and interfaces and stuff like that to try to distill out some of the commonality between them. But there always ends up being some amount of stuff I can't do as much distilling as I would like. So,
yeah. Whereas if you had effectively a parameterized type declaration,
right,
you'd get everything you wanted.
Yeah, like if I could execute, like, you know, for example, like if typing class foo was sugar for calling some sort of compile time declaration function with, you know, the string, you know, foo, here's my name of the class, and here's my array of all my fields, here's my array of all my methods and their definition, then that could be called, I don't know, I mean, it gets into basically going further down the road of having a compile time language, which might be overlapping quite a bit with Luke's work, and some of it might be further beyond that. I don't know.
Or maybe just Luke's work could be extended to do this kind of stuff.
Right.
The other side of it is that actually that overlaps with reflection in a funny way, because what if it was available both at compile time and runtime, and you could do runtime type creation and insert new types into the runtime? And that has a lot to do with reflection. It has to do with REPLs, and it has to do with
REPL.
And that's all really interesting stuff, and it becomes especially interesting in the context of distributed computing. So, not to be sniffed at, right? Like, that's quite interesting.
Yeah, although, you know, being able to add create a new type at runtime has a ton of other hairy names to it.
It's awful.
Compared to, yeah. I mean, I was thinking about this just the other day in the context of, you know, how can we have incremental compilation to speed up some compile times?
Yeah.
And, you know, even then, creating a new type at a later compile time, you know, has many of the same complications as to creating a new type at runtime.
It does. In fact, there's a one of the main things that we can use to start to address that is perfect hashing for dispatch. So there's a series of papers Roland. Roland Ducournau, I think is how it's pronounced. I'm sorry, Roland, I'm probably mangling your name if you ever listen to this. He's written some really nice papers on using perfect hashing for method dispatch. And basically his approach is no slower than what we're doing right now in terms of selector coloring at compile time. And maybe ever so slightly slower at runtime, but if so, it's like a single bitwise operation slower, right? So it's not problematically slower on dynamic dispatch. And possibly we would measure that as not being slower, right? Like it depends on, I don't know, we'd have to really measure it. But what that would do is create a situation where we could have our unthunked vtables and still be able to add types to the system. Because one of the hugest problems is selector coloring, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the other big problem is that adding a type can add many instantiations of generic types that you didn't have before. But if that's okay, if adding new types is okay, then adding new types is okay. And creating those new instantiations is okay too.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, and basically that sort of system would also take us partway toward REPL land and new types at runtime land.
Right. And then the other one that gets really interesting there is something that doesn't happen in most systems but might be possible in Pony, which would be garbage collection of code. That if you said, I would like to replace future new instantiations of this type with this other type, which then would have to fulfill, the new type you provide would have to be a perfect subtype of the type that you were replacing, right? There couldn't be an interface or trait that it didn't implement, right? But you could add stuff to it.
Or change the implementation if you had a bug you were fixing in a hot code reloading situation.
Right, exactly. So as long as it's a perfect subtype, you could replace it, and then you could theoretically detect when no live object was using the old type descriptor and actually garbage collect the code.
Pretty space age.
It's pretty space age, yeah. Oh, I like that. I'm going to start saying that. That's pretty sweet.
All right.
So that's a thing to think about.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm having a ridiculous amount of fun, but maybe we should actually try and go through some of the issues.
Yeah.
I've noticed that the app Veyer fix didn't fix.
In new PRs or in old PRs or in master?
Oh.
The app Veyer fix was that that Gordon did for us is only going to apply to new PRs that are based on a master branch that is at least that up to date, I think.
How silly of me. Of course. Yeah. Okay. Never mind. Yeah.
People could just touch the app Veyer YML file in their PRs if they want to. They can build again.
Oh, that's smart. Cool. Okay, cool. So we can just ask for that if we see something that might be problematic. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I was worried that I'd screwed up the AppVeyor configuration, and that's why it wasn't working on other PRs. But this makes way more sense. Cool. Excellent. On that note, then, are there any PRs that we're looking to possibly merge? I know 1421 is missing some stuff. But for example, is 1439 possibly
viable? I haven't looked at it yet, but Verlander's been doing some good string fixes for us recently.
Ooh. Uh-oh. Paralandric rebased from master and has the app layer problem. That's unexpected.
Is it from master?
Mm. I don't know. He 5 hours ago he said he rebased from master, but I don't know if that's really going to do what we think. And Travis is wedged. Yay. Okay, looks like maybe we should not be trying to deal with PRs given the state of CI right now. That's not the worst thing in the world. Okay. So, let's discuss 1441.
So yeah, just to confirm, okay. I just looked at Paralandric's Shaw, and he does have the AppVeyor fixes that we thought would fix AppVeyor. So if it's the same issue, then it was not a fix, or it broke again.
Oof. Okay. Okay, that's saddening, but you know, we can deal with that off the call. So 1441 for Lambda capture types is should be straightforward. I'm not entirely sure why Sean marked this as needs discussion, but we'll go over it just in case. So he wrote a pretty straightforward Lambda, but that Lambda was in a box receiver function. And it captures a field. And as a result, it really ought to capture the viewpoint adapted type of how this sees the field type. But instead, it captured the field type.
Okay, yeah, that's the bit of information I was missing from Sean's report. I was going through it and trying to figure out what was going on, but I didn't realize it was on a it was in a fun box.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was a field.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think an expression lambda when we pick up the captures and we say make capture field, I think that's where it's going goofy. Where it isn't drawing a distinction between fields and locals, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes sense to me now. I'm typing up a comment on the ticket.
Awesome. Yeah, because it says tree type in there, and it's called sanitized type, and it totally got an alias of the type, but it didn't pick up for a field that it should be how this sees the type.
Yeah, I'm adding a comment, and I'm also going to mark it as a bug and not an enhancement because it seems like it breaks capabilities.
Yeah, I mean, it won't actually let you do more.
Oh, okay. You sure? Because if it's capturing as a ref, then...
Right, because what it'll do is it'll just raise a compiler error. It'll say it wants a ref, and you don't have one.
Right. Okay, I still see it as a bug, though, because...
Yeah, so do I.
Okay.
It's a bug like, damn, that's annoying, though, as opposed to a bug like, oops, so much for safety.
Yeah. Thanks for the clarification. Okay, marking is bug, needs investor, I guess ready for work.
Yeah, I think so. It's pretty straightforward. Well, I'm not sure the solution is going to be straightforward, but at least we know where the problem is.
Yeah. Okay, label 5.
Awesome. All right. So we've... Sorry?
1445 is going to be interesting.
1445. All right. Let's have a look.
So this, the actual part that's discussed in the ticket, I guess we hadn't gotten around to putting more information in the ticket. What was going on, this is something discussed in IRC.
Damn, shoot. I think I understand.
Yeah, it was being passed to str2f without being null terminated first, which is an oversight on my part when I was doing that. But the other, this is encountered, and the fix for that is straightforward. You just use C string instead of underscore pointer.
Right.
What's weird is that the bug that made him notice this was basically the string literal. He was testing on ARM. The string literal 1.00, converting it to str2f, gave a really tiny number, a very infinitesimal number.
Oops.
And so far on IRC, we haven't figured out why this is happening, because even when C string is used instead of pointer, it doesn't solve the problem. And as somebody pointed out in the chat, string literals are null terminated.
They are, yeah.
While this ticket as reported was indeed the bug that we think it is, it's some other bug where on ARM but not on x86, this str2f function is doing bad stuff.
Yeah, I think so str2f and str2d are they can be problematic, and there are standard library implementations that are subtly wrong out there in the world, and or at least there used to be. It's possible that that's all been cleaned up over time and that I'm just out of date. Possibly the right thing to do is to rewrite string.f32 and string.f64 not to use FFI.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's not actually that hard to write those functions in Pony, right? It'll be somewhat easier than writing them in C, probably. That's totally my fault for originally doing that, because I just wanted to get it working. And to be honest, I forgot that those were in there.
Yeah, me too. I didn't know they were in there. I was like, what? String has .f32 on it?
Yeah.
So,
and it's possible that they should be pulled out, right? It's possible that really what we should be looking is to move those conversion functions into some other type. I don't know. Or maybe not.
That would be my instinct as well, that they're not really intrinsic to string. I know some people... some people really like the ergonomics of just being able to call dot, on any built-in object, but I sort of, tend to look at it as being like these built-in data types should have, pretty limited scope, and then the stuff you do to them can be other packages, but
yeah,
there's some debate to be had there, I think, in RFC.
Yeah, I mean, probably one of the big advantages of string to number conversion is that it's tricky to get right, and as a result, if there were some alternate package to do it, it could. It's very possible for such alternate packages to be inconsistent. There was a bug at a place that I worked that shall remain nameless, where someone believed that they had implemented a much, much, much faster string to float conversion. Perhaps it was, but it certainly gave an answer that was under some circumstances off by two orders of magnitude.
If this was a fintech, I imagine.
your imagination is very accurate.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So I'm, in that sense, yeah, having that kind of built-in conversion, I don't know. That's, I'm just biased by my experience, right? It doesn't mean it's right. It just means it makes me nervous.
Yeah, I mean, my counter argument to that would be, I think, converting a string to a number is not something that is sort of absolutely like this is like the universal function for converting a string to a number. I mean, yes, we do have a standard C function for doing it, but. There's various ways of interpreting, you know, how do you allow exponents, how do you handle them, like what they look like, and those are things that could be implemented differently or options on a more complex function. So I think there is room for some competition.
And there's a reason why people end up using SprintF to do stuff, right? Like it's complex and the options that you need are pretty hefty. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the right answer is. But certainly we should probably stop using strdf and strdd.
Right. Okay. So I definitely agree with you there. I just, and that was kind of my instinct as well, but I just wanted to kind of, we also want to make sure that this is not like a more general problem with FFI or with pointers or, you think it's just a buggy stir to F on his platform.
I don't, because I'll bet you he turns around and uses that from C and it doesn't go wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. So my question is, are we returning F32s from FFI wrong on ARM, or are we passing pointers wrong on ARM, or something bad with FFI on ARM that this is demonstrating to us?
Right.
That won't get fixed, obviously, by just getting rid of the FFI call.
Right. Well, that's a really good question. I wonder if we need some built-in test FFI tests on... It really sucks to write FFI tests, though, because we did add one for bony test callback, but to do so, it meant that we actually had to add something to the runtime, which is this test callback, which is damned annoying and not really what we want to do, because we're not, going out and compiling arbitrary C code when we build our test cases for obvious reasons. I think maybe at least some kind of program and examples that with some C code that we can compile that we can check on a couple different architectures and experiment with. I'm not too concerned about returning structures, returning tuples, like not pointers to structs, but actual structs on the stack, because that's handled so differently on so many different platforms that I'm okay with saying it simply doesn't work.
We talked about that, yeah.
But I am concerned about like F32 being returned incorrectly on ARM. That would be not good. It shouldn't be. There's no reason that should be returning small value. That's concerning. Yeah. The more I think about that, the more that's just... As much as getting rid of Strata F is a good idea, and it is, I'm just looking at this code, and on a string literal, we're offsetting on the index, which means we're just returning pointer, and we're passing in a zero U size, and the U size is interpreted as a pointer to a pointer, and when it's null, we're not trying to write to it, right? That's the libc semantics.
Yeah, and just a sanity check, a pointer is always the same size as a U size, right? That's the guarantee we're aiming for?
Yeah.
Okay. I wonder if that's wrong. Like, I wonder if our U size determining code is somehow wrong on his ARM platform.
It could be. And then we've got a stack offset, and then we're not returning what we think we're returning. That's possible. That's a really good thought.
Okay, so I guess the question would be, for debugging purposes, what's the easiest way for us to print the size of a type in the U size type in Pony? I need to check.
It's U size dot width.
That's right. Okay.
Assuming I haven't misremembered the name of the, it's not width. It's bit width. U size dot bit width.
Okay. So I think he's in IRC right now. I'm just going to ask him to see that.
All right, cool. Just a warning, we've got 5 minutes until Sean will need the Zoom account, so...
Cool, okay. Well,
we'll have to cover things. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
But this is... Yeah. Because, yeah, the bug is real in terms of C-string, but... It is more concerning than that. And 1446 is interesting too, because So recalc, the idea behind recalc is for when you've made an FFI call, passed it some space to write to, and what you're trying to do is determine, you're saying that the FFI call may have written any amount of stuff, but it will have null terminated it, and you're going to try and go figure out how long the string is that the FFI call wrote to that available space.
Yeah, and you don't want to iterate yourself because that would be slower.
I mean, theoretically you could, right? Like, you could read through it and you could use apply and all that stuff. But a classic example is in file.pony, line 258, where we're reading lines out of a file and we do an fgets. And we've passed in a certain amount of space, and fgets will, you know, let us know its return value. And you know, we pay attention to things like, oops, it was, you know, was, did we not have enough space and all that stuff. But we do call result.recalc to figure out how much data was written in by fgets. Because sadly, fgets does not return that.
Yeah, so my question would be about that specific part of the documentation where it says if a null terminator is not encountered, and what should be the behavior there now that we have the requirement of not all strings have to be null terminated.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, I would say that if a null terminator is not encountered, it scans the entire allocated space. There's no null terminator in there. It just says, okay, well, size is the entire allocated space.
Without adding the null.
Although, I guess, if you're calling recalc, Without adding the null. If you're calling recalc, you're kind of asserting my string now has a null terminator. So maybe what we should do instead is if it goes through, doesn't find a null terminator,
raise an error.
Zero. Or raise an error. But I was going to say set size to zero, so at least you're not leaking any memory. But raising an error maybe would be the correct thing.
That's interesting.
And when I mean leaking memory, I don't mean like a memory leak. I mean like...
You mean examining memory that you shouldn't be examining.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Strangely, that's what I thought you meant. if you were to not call recalc, then it would not, it would, yeah, then you wouldn't have the size, unless we had the issue with undefined, but on a string, that's not an issue. Yeah, so zero would work.
Yeah, because you're right. If you had never called recalc, size would be the same as whatever it was before, which on a fresh string would be zero.
Right. Or if you'd written some to it, well, then you'd written some to it, and that's cool. That's allowed. So you're right. Zero would work.
Okay.
Yeah, so it should be one of those two. Either it should set to the size to zero if it's not null terminated, or it should raise an error. Because this is... Yeah. As the comment makes clear, right, it's for FFI. There's just no point in calling that otherwise.
Yeah. Benoit, do you have a preference about returning zero from recalc when there's no null terminator or raising an error?
I just joined the call, so okay. I didn't follow all the conversation. But on the topic of the null terminator itself, I think we should completely remove it from the pony side and just deal with it when somebody calls a C string and wants to do a FFI. Because I feel like there are lots of problems in that area, and maybe it could offer some a bit more performance to not deal with the null terminator.
Yeah, well, but in this case with recalc, you're saying you're calling a function like fgets, and there's no and it's filling a string buffer for you, and there's no way for you to it doesn't return the number of bytes written, so there's no way for you to populate that except for finding where the null terminator is in the newly populated string.
Yeah.
Also, what's the question about recalc?
Then the question is that what should the behavior be if either you got the code wrong or the C function misbehaved and did not put a null terminator in your string? Whether it should give your string size zero, or it should raise an error, or I guess the other option would be just to leave the size unchanged from whatever it was before.
Interesting.
Is it possible to use it badly without a prior FFI call?
No. If there's no prior FFI call, then.
Oh, that's a good point, actually, because. If you just called it on a string, you would want the behavior to be my size. You know, my size shouldn't change. There should be nothing to recalculate. You know, in terms of like, should be like an idempotent operation.
Right. That's an excellent point, Benoit. And so, what you said is, don't change it. If we don't find an null terminator, don't change it.
Yeah, I think that's the best solution.
Okay. I'm afraid we have to wrap up so that Sean doesn't kill me and I want to live. So it's time to wrap up, unfortunately. Thanks, everybody. And see you next week.
Yep. And I will record those couple of comments that we just talked about.
Excellent. Okay. Bye, y'all.